This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. The answers in this episode are accurate at the time of recording this episode in March 2024. Evidence, research, and practices are changing all the time, so please refer to Breast Cancer Now's website for the most up-to-date and reliable information. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. This episode follows on from our last conversation with Dr. Liz O'Riordan and Dan Wills, where we discussed the important topic of how to make sure you're finding the most reputable and trusted information in regards to a breast cancer diagnosis. We talked about whether it's ever okay to consult Dr. Google and how to do so safely, and we also discussed the green tick from the Patient Information Forum that you can use to find out if the information you're reading online can be trusted. Now, Dr. Liz O'Riordan is a trusted information creator, and she's also a former breast cancer surgeon who has had breast cancer 3 times. She's the host of the podcast So Now I've Got Breast Cancer and the author of The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer and her 2023 memoir, Under the Knife. Liz is here to answer the questions about cancer that many of us are too afraid to ask. Dr. Liz O'Riordan, thank you so much for joining us today on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thanks for having me, Laura. I'm really looking forward to it.
Before we start, you are Dr. Liz O'Riordan, but you are a surgeon.
Yes.
And surgeons are usually called Mr. or Mrs. Why is that, and how come you're a doctor?
Well, it all started back to barber surgeons when surgeons didn't really have medical qualifications, so they weren't called doctor, and that kind of prestige carried on. So surgeons are called Mr. or Miss or Mrs., whereas doctors are called doctor. But I also have a PhD, so I'm Dr. Miss Doctor. It gets very confusing. But that's why if you go to see your surgeon, they'll be Mr. or Miss or Mrs.
Yes, I remember being very confused when I was first diagnosed because I was diagnosed by a surgeon who was Mr.
Yeah.
And
We get very upset if you call us doctor on the wards.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. So let's go back to basics.
Yeah.
What is cancer?
How long have you got? So I used to describe cancer as a series of spelling mistakes. Each cell has your DNA inside it, which basically tells the cell what it's going to do, how it's going to react, how it's going to grow. And over time, as the cells replicate and divide, spelling mistakes happen and your body can fix them. But some of those spelling mistakes don't get fixed. And if they can act a bit like traffic lights, they can make a cell stop growing completely, or they can make it keep growing and growing when it's not needed. And if you get enough of those spelling mistakes that happen in the right order at the right time, a cell can become a cancerous cell. And that means it can find its own food, it can grow its own blood supply, it can grow without anyone telling it not to, and it can move around the body. And there are various stages. So with breast cancer, we have DCIS, or ductal carcinoma in situ. And that's a cancerous cell that doesn't have the ability to move around the body, so it can't spread. When that next spelling mistake happens, that's when you have a cancer. And it generally takes 5 to 10 years for all those changes to happen. Most breast cancers are generally slow growing, and it takes a long time for all those changes to happen. And that's why breast cancer is still a disease of the elderly. It's much more common in women over the age of 65, because the older you are, the less good the body is at repairing those spelling mistakes and that damage. So it's more likely to happen, like when our hair goes grey as we get older.
Wow. Okay, thank you. So when we talk about cancer, we talk about stages and grades. So
yes.
Stage 3, stage 4, grade,
yeah.
Grade 2, grade 3, etc. What are stages and what are grades, please?
I'm going to start with grade because that's the easiest one. A grade tells your pathologist what your breast cancer looks like under the microscope and how different it is from a normal breast cell. Grade 1 is slightly abnormal. Grade 3 is very abnormal. Grade 1s tend to be slow growing, and grade 2 and 3 are fast growing and more potentially aggressive in behaviour. They look much more different from the normal cell. So grade 1, 2, 3. Stage is basically a doctor's shorthand of describing how likely a breast cancer is to come back in the future. Before we had all the computer algorithms, it was a rough thing that we'd work out in the back of our heads. Stage 1 is the smallest. That's generally small cancers under 2 centimetres that haven't spread to the lymph nodes. Stage 3 is a cancer that's generally between 2 and 5 centimetres that may have spread to the lymph nodes. Stage 4 means that it's metastatic. Stage 0 means that it's DCIS, so a cancer that can't spread. However, In 2018, things got a lot more complicated because we realised breast cancers are sneaky. They're very, very different. There were five new different types called luminal A, luminal B, basal that you might have heard of. And that means that a breast cancer cell can grow in various ways depending on whether it's ER positive or HER2 positive or triple negative. So the staging system now has your tumour size, the grade, the nodes, how old you are, all your receptors, sometimes how fast it's growing. And I can't remember. I need to look it up in a textbook. So I was a stage 3 cancer when I was diagnosed in 2015. In the new system, I'm now a stage 1B. Because we know the behaviour of my cancer means it is less likely to grow. And everyone gets worried. It's like a badge of honour. What stage are you? We don't use it to work out what treatment you need. It's basically a shorthand for the team.
Okay. Let's talk about those receptors. So you mentioned, so when a patient receives a diagnosis of breast cancer, they are told that they are ER positive or ER negative, HER2 positive or negative, and progesterone as well.
That's right.
What do those things mean, please?
Every breast cancer cell can have up to 3 receptors that are overexpressed on its surface. And a receptor is a bit like a lock, and you have a key that comes along and opens it. 70% of breast cancers overexpress estrogen and progesterone receptors. We don't use the progesterone receptor at all. It's like a double check. If you're ER positive, you should be PR positive as well. And that means if your breast cancer cell is stimulated by estrogen, it will make it grow much more quickly. HER2 is overexpressed in about 10 or 15% of breast cancers, and that tends to make the cell grow much more quickly than estrogen and progesterone. And what we want to do is have a look at your cancer to see which of those receptors it expresses. And depending on the receptors, it will give us an idea of how quickly your breast cancer might grow, how likely it is to come back, and what treatment you might need to try and stop it coming back in the future.
So is it HER2 or Herceptin that's the protein?
HER2 is the protein. Herceptin is the name of the drug that's used to treat HER2-positive breast cancers.
And what does the HER2 protein do in the body function? Is it purely cancer related, or does it do something else? Because obviously estrogen does something else.
Yeah, no, it's a growth factor. And it works in the nucleus of breast cancer cells and a lot of other normal cells in the body that stimulates it to grow. A bit like a series of traffic lights saying green, you can grow, red, you can't.
Okay. And what does the term triple negative mean?
So triple negative means that your breast cancer doesn't express any of those receptors. And that's about 10% of all breast cancers. It's got nothing to do with grade. It's got nothing to do with stage or how big or small the cancer is.
But it does mean that you can't receive certain drug treatments that you can. So if you're ER positive or HER2 positive, there is a drug for each of those things. So what access to drugs do you have if you're triple negative?
So if I go back, I'll say the main treatment of breast cancer is surgery, and everybody will have surgery plus or minus radiotherapy. Everything else we do is to reduce the risk of it coming back. The chemotherapy works regardless of the receptors. Those are drugs that stop cancer cells dividing quickly. If you are ER positive, we can give you drugs that either stop you producing estrogen or stop your breast cells recognising it. And they're things like tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors. If you have the HER2 receptor, we can give you drugs that stop that receptor working, like Herceptin and Keytruda and Phesgo. If you're triple negative, that's where it gets more difficult, especially if triple negative breast cancers come back, because they don't have as many options in the future.
Chris Hallinger's cancer was ER positive and HER2 negative originally,
right,
15
yes.
years ago, and it became HER2 positive. Yeah. Is that something that is that quite common for a cancer to change its receptor status over time?
It is. So triple negatives can develop estrogen receptors, and HER2 negative cancers can develop HER2 receptors. And that's why ideally anyone with metastatic disease should have a biopsy of the cancer, because if it has changed receptors, there may be more treatment lines available.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. So more terminology now.
Yeah.
Many people will have heard about the BRCA genes or the BRCA gene mutation, which was first made more famous, I guess, more well-known by Angelina Jolie, who had the preventative double mastectomy, I think. And there are other gene mutations such as PALB2, which is the one that I have, which sometimes people refer to as BRCA3.
Yeah.
What is a gene mutation?
So a gene mutation is inherited from one of your parents at birth, and only 5% of all breast cancers are due to inherited mutations. BRCA1 and BRCA2 stand for breast cancer. They were the first two that we diagnosed. There's PALB2, which you have, CHEK2. There's also a Lynch syndrome with a mutation in the P53 protein. if you have those, it means that you kind of jumped along the line of spelling mistakes. So instead of starting at 1 going up to 6, you may already be at number 5. So you have a 60 to 80% chance of developing breast and ovarian cancer in your lifetime if you have BRCA. So you only need one more spelling mistake for a breast cancer to happen.
Ah, I see.
Does that make sense?
So it's sort of everyone with cancer has spelling mistakes, but yep. People with gene mutations are born with spelling mistakes. Yep. And so it only takes a little typo to make
exactly.
the cancer come on.
So that's why your lifetime risk of getting breast cancer, if you don't have any genetic mutations, is about 12 to 17% in your lifetime. That's if you live to 85. If you've got the BRCA gene, it can be 60 to 80%. So you're kind of two-thirds of the way there of the list of spelling mistakes.
And the PALB2 mutation is a lot lower in ovarian cancer
risk.
But it's still relatively high for breast cancer risk.
That's right.
And is it, because when I was diagnosed in 2012, testing for PALB2 was not yet done.
No.
So I was tested for BRCA and tested negative.
Yeah.
And then it was only when I was got my secondary diagnosis in 2022 that they retested my DNA, which they still had on record, and found that I was PALB2 positive. So are there lots of other gene mutations that are still not testable?
We only know what we know at the time. That's the problem. So we now know, again, as you said, the PALB2, the CHEK2, we are adding more and more mutations to test when young women are diagnosed, and that will continue to increase as we know more. There are lots of women and men with a strong family history, and we don't know what's causing it. And it may be that gene will get diagnosed in 3 years' time, and we'll add that to the list of things we test for.
In my case, and in the case of some other people I know, yeah. I have a genetic mutation, and I had breast cancer in my 20s.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, along the same line, also had breast cancer young. But my mother, in the middle, has not had breast cancer and she's in her 70s. We all have the genetic mutation.
Yeah.
What could be possibly the difference between me and my mum that made me get breast cancer young and she didn't get it?
We may never know. We know that only 60 to 80% of people with it get breast cancer and some don't. It could just be luck. That final spelling mistake didn't happen to your mum, but it happened in you. We don't know why. Or maybe the combination of different genes that you had when your mum married your dad. We just don't know. And that's the problem with the genetic mutations. You can blame yourself if you had it, but your sister didn't. Or it's really, really hard to feel that, why me, why not them? But we don't know, sadly.
How many different types of breast cancer are there?
13.
And can you give us
Please
some examples?
Ask me to name them. So that's they all come from the different types of cell in the breast. So this is not due to triple negative or ER positive. These are the cells in the breast. Most are no special type or invasive ductal cancer. And if you don't know what type of breast cancer you have, it's ductal, because most come from the cells in the breast that line the ducts that take milk through to the nipple. And because milk has calcium, that's why you see the little white spots of calcium on a mammogram that look like the cancer that you can see. The next biggest category is lobular cancer, which is what I had. And that's the lobules in the breast around the duct that produce the milk that go into them. You then have inflammatory breast cancer, which can look like inflammation of the breast. And that's when the dermal lymphatics, the tiny tubes in the skin of the breast that carry lymph fluid, become cancerous. Then you've got tubular and metaplastic and mucinous and papillary and micropapillary. There's also Paget's disease of the nipple, which can happen. So there are 13 different types in total, but they all generally behave the same, apart from lobular.
And can men get breast cancer?
Yes, about 1 in 300 men get breast cancer. Again, it is more common in older men, but it does happen. And it's often mistaken for jogger's nipple. Men will get bleeding from the nipple or a small lump, but it can happen.
Okay. This might be a difficult question, but what causes cancer?
Oh, so we know that genetic mutations can cause them, inherited. We know that carcinogens can cause them. These are chemicals that directly cause cancer. Tobacco is the obvious one. Alcohol is another carcinogen. Now, if you told me when I was 20 as a medical student that alcohol caused cancer, I knew that. I was still going to drink. But we know it directly causes 7 cancers, including breast cancer. We know that being overweight or having an increased body fatness can cause 13 cancers, and that's hard to hear, but it can happen. There are also lots of lifestyle factors, which some people call epigenetic. What you eat, how you live, how much you exercise. We know exercise can reduce your risk of cancer by 30%. But for most people, it is bad luck. These mutations just happen, and if they happen in the right order, a cancer develops. It's really easy for someone like me who drank like a fish at medical school to think breast cancer is my fault. Alcohol may have caused one of those spelling mistakes, but the rest could just be bad luck. But there are things we can do to reduce the risk of it happening, and that comes down to lifestyle factors.
Is it true that stress causes cancer?
No.
Is it true that when the immune system is suppressed, that that's when cancer can grow?
Oh, we know that people who eat an unhealthy diet and don't exercise and have high levels of body fatness are more likely to get breast cancer and more likely for their cancer to come back. And they can all affect your immune system. But there are people with very healthy immune systems who still get breast cancer. But I think if your immune system is permanently low, that may have an impact on it coming back. But because we don't routinely measure your immune system, there is no way of being able to say with proof it came back because of this or because of that. But generally, the healthier you are, the better the chance you'll have.
Something that's been occurring to me lately is that I'm on medication which suppresses my immune system.
Me too.
And my medication is to make me better and protect me from my cancer. And I'm trying to eat all the good foods and try and, you know, bump my immune system up. But how does it not seem that those two things are in conflict?
It does, actually. It is really quite hard to get your head around. I think when you are on drugs to treat metastatic breast cancer, you are trying to kill cells that are actively growing. And the problem is your immune system is based in your bone marrow, which is actively producing white blood cells. So if you're stopping that working, they're going to drop. Now, white blood cells are generally fighting bacteria and viruses, not cancer cells. There are other cells in the immune system that do that. So it's that balance of stopping you getting an infection that could kill you whilst trying to kill the cancer cells as well. But we know the pros of having those treatments are much better than the cons of not having them. But that's why we say try and exercise and sleep well and eat a healthy diet to try and keep your immune system as healthy as you can.
Moving on to possibly the bit that everyone's been waiting for, which is diet and exercise. So there are lots of myths around breast cancer and things like turmeric, sugar, going vegan or plant-based. When someone is diagnosed, is there like a definitive thing that they should or shouldn't do in terms of diet and exercise?
There is one definitive thing they should do regarding diet and one definitive thing they should do during exercise. And most doctors and oncologists aren't aware that breast cancer patients are scouring the internet looking for diets and supplements that will cure them. And they don't know the evidence behind exercise. So should we start with diet and do that first?
Yeah.
The diet for any cancer patient is the same as a diet for any healthy person. And the World Cancer Research Federation has looked at every single study on there. It's an amazing resource of information. You should eat a plant-based diet. And what that means is a rainbow of fruit and vegetables, a good 5 or 6 portions a day, every day. Ideally, lentils and beans and chickpeas, brown bread, brown pasta, brown rice. Limit processed meat. We know if you eat a lot of processed meat, that can increase the risk of bowel cancer. And limit the amount of kind of things like sausages and bacon and salami, the ultra-processed meats. Fish is fine. You don't need to eat meat to get your protein source, but it can be hard to get your protein needs if you don't eat meat. So vegan diets can be very, very unhealthy. You should limit the amount of alcohol you drink. And if you're having a healthy diet full of fruit and veg, you shouldn't need to take a vitamin or a mineral supplement. That's it.
When you say plant-based, does that mean vegan?
No. You do not need to be vegan or vegetarian after you've had cancer, and being vegan or vegetarian will not impact your cancer outcome. But if you used to live off cheeseburgers and you suddenly eat a load of fruit and veg every day, you're going to be much healthier and it may lead to a better outcome in the future.
Is it true that sugar feeds cancer?
Yes, but sugar feeds every cell. This is based on a theory by Otto Warburg in the 1930s that's debunked, and I had a paper in The Lancet that you can put a link in just to explain why. The easiest food resource for your every cell in the body to use is sugar. It's glucose. Your brain needs it. And what people don't realise is that donuts are broken down to glucose, but so are cabbages and apples and bananas and rice and potatoes. Almost every carbohydrate you eat is broken down to glucose, and that is your body's easiest source for energy. When you don't have sugar, you use protein and fat. So when you don't eat sugar, you are starving everything. And most people who are doing this have already had their cancer treated. So my breast cancer has been removed. I'm on tamoxifen to stop it coming back. There is no cancer to starve. But cancers are sneaky because they can make their own food supply. They can just start using protein and fat without glucose. So it is complete rubbish.
And so it's not true then if you eat loads and loads and loads of sugar, you know, you have a really high sugar diet in the sense of chocolate and sweets and things. Is that particularly bad in terms of feeding your cancer?
That's bad for you in a different way. If you eat a lot of high processed foods with a lot of sugar, you're just giving all of your body an easy energy source. And that means that you're more likely to gain weight and to gain fat. And the more fat you have, the more estrogen you produce, the more inflammation you have in your fats, the more likely you are to develop cancer and develop a recurrence. But it doesn't feed cancer specifically. It feeds all the cells in your body.
So it's fine for me to eat a regular amount of chocolate or something sweet every day. Cake.
I work on the 80-20 rule. A, I've had cancer, so I'm not going to live off a boring diet. Plus, it's hard to cook your food all the while. I think if 80% of the time I'm eating a lot of fruit and veg, then it's fine if I have cake or a glass of champagne, because you need to enjoy your food. It should be fun as well. So don't feel guilty about having the cake or having the chocolate. Just don't eat a kilo of whole nut every day.
I do like whole nut, though. It's a good one.
It is.
What about dairy?
It's completely safe. This comes off the back of a book that said that dairy causes breast cancer. But she said, I think it was Jane Plant, I cut out dairy and I cured my breast cancer. But she'd also had surgery and was taking tamoxifen. Dairy is safe. You do not need to worry about the hormone levels in milk. It's completely safe for you. But this comes off, Christy Funk was Angelina Jolie's breast surgeon, and she wrote a book saying that we know, and we don't know why, the taller you are as a woman, the higher your risk of getting breast cancer. In countries like the Netherlands, where women are very tall, they have more breast cancer. So she said, stop giving your young girls milk, stunt their growth to reduce their risk. It's ridiculous. You need dairy for your bones, for the calcium and vitamin D.
And when you say we don't need to worry about the hormones in milk, for example. Yeah. I always try to drink organic milk, for example, or buy organic chicken if I eat chicken, because I do have this belief somewhere, maybe because I've read it too many times, about hormones being in certain foods. Is there some truth in that? Or
I think in some parts in America where they are mass farming beef, then there may be a larger amount of hormones. But the food you get in the UK is very well regulated. Eat organic if it makes you feel better, if you prefer the taste, but you don't need to from an estrogen point of view regarding your breast cancer.
Okay.
Soy as well is completely safe, but not soy supplements. Soy supplements aren't regulated and can have a massive amount of soy and estrogen in them, but it's fine to eat soy as part of a diet, tofu. It's all completely fine.
What's an example of a soy supplement? Like soy,
things
like
you literally can get in Holland and Barrett. You can get soy supplements, soy powders that people are taking because they think they're good for them. Supplements aren't regulated. If we have a paracetamol, we know it has 500 milligrams of paracetamol in it. A third of the supplements sold on Amazon don't have what they contain. They're not regulated. Companies can put anything you like in them.
I mean, I would say never buy medication or supplements on Amazon, to be
but
honest.
Anything you'd buy in Holland and Barrett. There is no regulation by law to say it has to contain what it says.
Right.
It may say it's got a gram of turmeric, but it doesn't have to have a gram of turmeric, and you don't know what it's cut with. So,
red meat, is that okay every so often, as long as not heavily processed?
I think red meat is fine in moderation, maybe once a week. You shouldn't really be having steak and mince every day. We do know that eating processed meat, bacon, sausage can double your risk of getting breast cancer, but that doesn't mean you've got a 50-50 chance. It slightly increases it. And you need to be eating salami and chorizo like three times a day at every meal. So again, every once in a while is fine. Pepperoni pizza is completely fine, just not every day of the week.
Do you mind me asking, do you eat meat?
Yes, I do.
And you eat cake?
I eat meat, I eat cake, I eat chocolate. I've had cancer three times, life is too hard. But I do eat a lot of fruit and veg and try to eat a lot of beans and lentils just to bulk things up and help the constipation, which is another side effect of the joyful drugs we're on.
Yes. We do know there's a clear link between alcohol and breast cancer, which we've talked about a little bit already. Yeah. You've also mentioned that alcohol is a carcinogen, which I heard that first from you a while ago, and I was quite surprised, actually. Does that mean that we shouldn't drink alcohol at all?
There is no good reason to drink alcohol from a health point of view. It is a chemical that has been shown to prove 7 different cancers. And if you drink and smoke, you're much more likely to get cancer of the mouth than you are if you just drink alcohol. It also, alcohol gets broken down to fat, and fat is where you produce the aromatase enzyme that produces estrogen. So that's another way it increases the risk of breast cancer. But it's a nice thing to do socially, because every social event is, let's go out for a drink. It's your birthday. Have a drink. It's the party. Have a drink. I can't dance unless I'm drunk. It's fine. Stick to the guidelines, which I think is 14 units a week for women. We're not sure how much you should drink after breast cancer. The evidence seems to be 5 units a week, but there's some saying actually that's not true. You may be able to have a bit more. But again, hangovers take me back to chemo and I don't want to go there. And it doesn't matter whether you binge drink it all or you spread it out through the week. It's the quantity in a week that's bad for you. So drink sensibly if you enjoy it, and have a glass of wine and really enjoy it. But don't make it a habit.
What should you drink if you're not drinking alcohol?
Ideally, we should all drink water, plain, boring water, because that's what our cells need. It's fine to drink Diet Cokes and sugar-sweetened drinks and fruit juice, but not all the time, because they've got a load of chemicals and things in them.
Is aspartame not bad as well?
Aspartame doesn't cause breast cancer. That's the artificial sweetener. You'd need to drink 40 cans of Coke a day to get anywhere near increasing your risk of cancer from the artificial chemicals in diet sodas. So,
and some people say that there are hormones in water even.
No,
is that not the
case? No. There's, you can get alkaline water for the pH diet, and got super hydrogen water. It's all rubbish.
But water from the tap is safe.
Water from the tap
is
completely
saying.
Fine. Yeah. Yes, you do not need to buy filters or chemicals or buy crazy bottled water unless that makes you feel better.
Yeah. On to carcinogens. So yes. if you have a slice of toast and it's got a tiny bit of burnt on the edge of it, or you have a barbecue chicken and it's a little bit, it's got that lovely crispy black bit on the skin, is that particularly dangerous, or can you just have a little bit of that every so often?
It's fine. Burnt food is fine. Again, if you are, if every meal you eat has got burnt food in it, then it might increase your risk of breast cancer, but the risk is very, very, very low. So burnt toast, if you're weird and like your toast black, that's completely fine. Charcoal barbecued food is completely fine.
Just every so often.
There is no food you need to avoid to reduce your risk of getting breast cancer or to reduce the risk of it coming back.
Okay.
No food.
What about the gut microbiome and fermented foods?
Ooh, good question. This is becoming a thing, the gut microbiome. Basically, you have bacteria in your colon that help you digest and process food. And when you eat a healthy diet, you don't have a lot of them, it can make you poorly. You get the gut bacteria from the food you eat, which is basically plant-based, fruit, veg, fiber, chickpeas, all of that stuff. If you're living off white bread and white pasta, you're not getting it. You can eat live yogurt and fermented food to boost them, but you don't need to. If you like the taste of them, that's fine, have them. The bad thing is when you're juicing everything and you're putting it in the NutriBullets, you're losing the fiber. And again, with a normal healthy diet, you shouldn't need to alter the microbiome. And we know that sending your poo off in a lab doesn't give an accurate representation of what your gut microbiome is like. So again, it just comes back to eating a boring, healthy diet. But live yogurt, kombucha, kimchi, it's all fine if you want to add it in. But you don't need to. If you don't like it, don't worry.
Okay. Should we be fasting?
What's the reasons for fasting that you're asking me?
Well, I've just seen a lot of stuff online about fasting and how it's, you know, there are certain benefits.
Yeah. I've just done a podcast about this with Claire Shaw, who's the Marsden's ex-dietitian. Fasting makes no difference on cancer outcomes. There is no evidence to say that fasting will stop your cancer coming back. There are trials that have looked at it to reduce the side effects of chemotherapy, and it may make a difference. It doesn't make it work any better. Lots of people think that. And actually, the 2 or 3 days before chemo, when your taste buds are coming back, the last thing I want to do is live off broth. And you need the energy to recover from chemotherapy. So it may help with some of the side effects, but there is no clinical need to. There are trials going on to look at people doing the 5-2 diet as a way of trying to control the weight gain that you can have and see if that makes a difference, but you don't need to.
Okay. There's been a lot of stuff in the media about ultra-processed foods or UPF. What is an ultra-processed food?
That is a food that has gone through several different processes, so it looks very dissimilar from what it was when it came out of the ground. So let's take supermarket bread. Could be ultra-processed because bread is basically water, flour, yeast, sugar, milk. And when you add all the chemicals to add the preservatives, that's an ultra-processed food. When you start blending things and making them into ready meals and all the various additives, they are ultra-processed. Basically things that come in a packet. But it's expensive to cook your own food. and we work, and I don't have the time to go and do this. You see these influencers just chopping everything away and think, well, great, that's your job, but I'm not like that. If all you eat is ultra-processed food, it is bad for you because it won't have the vitamins, the minerals that you need to live a long and healthy diet. But again, every once in a while, it's fine.
Is it the processing that makes it unhealthy, or is it the addition of things like emulsifiers that are actually bad for us?
I think it depends on the food. You could say that milk is processed because it's been pasteurised.
But it's not ultra-processed.
But it's not ultra-processed. Butter is processed, but it's not ultra-processed. I think when things are stripped down, cooked, you lose the fibre, you lose the taste. They add in chemicals, they add in colourings, they add in preservatives. And it's so far away from the original food. Like a cheap burger you might get in a supermarket shop for a pound is very different if you were to make your own with freshly ground mince. And I think it's really the cheaper foods that you get in packages that are really bad for you. But we can't all afford to eat healthily all the time. So again, it's just being aware of what you're putting in your mouth and trying to do the best you can.
If we make a nice healthy meal with some whole foods, but we add in an ingredient that is ultra processed, for example, an ultra processed sauce or a pesto or whatever, which is actually ultra processed, is it fine? So it's not that the one small bit of UPF cancels out everything else.
I think it's very easy to worry and get obsessed, and it's hard enough trying to feed your family than worry about what you're eating. A normal diet with your ketchup, with your mayonnaise, whatever you want. Food should be fun. It is boring and hard work to eat food that comes out of the ground that doesn't come out of a packet. It is completely unrealistic in the life we have. I mean, I'll be eating ultra-processed food on the train on the way home. Don't tell my coach. You have to be able to live your life. I think it's 80-20.
Yeah, so that's 80% good whole
foods. Be good 80% of the time,
In terms of exercise, is it correct that a certain amount of exercise can help prevent cancer recurrence and cancer in the first place?
Yes. And not a lot of people know this, because as a doctor, you may get 3 days off a year to go to conferences. And I go to breast cancer conferences, not exercise conferences. And I wasn't trained how to teach a healthy person to exercise, let alone someone with breast cancer and mets and diabetes. But we know you should be doing 3 half-an-hour aerobic sessions a week. And that means getting your heart rate up so you can only talk in a couple of words, getting hot and sweaty, and 2 weight-based sessions. And you can do that at home, squats and lunges and push-ups against the wall. That can reduce the risk of recurrence by 30%. And it can reduce the risk of you getting breast cancer by 30%. And it can help with all the side effects. It's the best thing for fatigue. It can help with anxiety, depression, the muscle aches and pains. It can help with the menopause. It can help you get a good night's sleep.
And when you say aerobic exercise, you don't mean aerobics in the traditional keep fit sense.
It's cardio.
Yeah.
So running, swimming, tennis, dancing, hot yoga, anything that gets your heart rate up. Now, ideally, some of that could be fast walking. I swim and I bike, and they're not very good for my bones, because after the menopause, or if you're on aromatase inhibitors, your risk of getting weak bones goes up. So ideally, some kind of foot-based. So tennis, dancing, running, jogging, where you are putting your weight through your feet will help.
Is it true that the only symptoms of breast cancer are a lump in the breast?
No, it's not. There are lots of symptoms of breast cancer. And you need to look at your breasts, because you may only see them by looking in the mirror. You may see a dimple. And that's because breast cancer is attached to the connective tissue that holds your breast to your chest muscle. So when you lift your hands up, the skin may be tethered. So looking to see a dimple or a puckering in the skin before you see a lump. You can get a rash on the breast, a hot red rash that can look like an inflammation, but that could be inflammatory breast cancer. You can get bleeding from the nipple, or your nipple can be pulled in. That's called inversion, and you can't pull it back out again. You may find a lump in your armpit, which is an enlarged lymph gland. Pain is controversial. It's not a true symptom of breast cancer that is recognised. And most women with breast cancer and pain, the pain is a coincidence. But it can be in a very small percentage of women. And I would say to anyone, if you've got a change in your breast that is different and it's been there for 2 or 3 weeks, go and get it checked out, because that worrying at home is horrific.
And that worrying at home just doesn't do anything. There's no solution there.
No.
So if listeners have had breast cancer already and been through chemotherapy and everything else, and they want to look out for the signs and symptoms of secondary breast cancer, what should they look out for?
The first thing I would say is to look for symptoms of a local recurrence, because that can happen in about 1% to 5% of people. So that's looking for a red spot or a little rash or a nodule around where the scar was. it's almost unheard of to get a recurrence at the back of a reconstruction, the back of an implant or a DIEPS. You don't need to worry about that, but you do need to check the area around the breast skin and the scar. The symptoms of a recurrence can be anything, depending on the kind of cancer you've had. Most breast cancers are ductal, and that tends to go to the liver, the lungs, and the bones. And it's generally a symptom that you've had for 2 or 3 weeks that you can't explain that isn't going away. So a cough that's not getting better, feeling short of breath, pain in your hip at night. Now, I had this. I thought pain in the hip would be at the side of your hip, but it's not. Hip pain is actually in the groin, close to your crotch. It's not on the outside of the hip. And bone pain tends to be worse at night and doesn't get better. A swollen tummy, feeling tired. HER2-positive breast cancers tend to go to the brain, so dizziness, confusion, seeing double. Lobular cancer is a sneaky little so-and-so because what it likes to do is grow in sheets around organs. So that can go to the lining of your bowel, your stomach, your ovaries, so you can get indigestion, stomach pain, swollen tummy. They're really vague. There's a great diagram on the Breast Cancer Now website to go and have a look. But if you have a symptom that you can't explain, put it in your phone and then set an alarm to check 2 or 3 weeks later. And if it's still there, go and see your GP and tell them, I have had breast cancer and I think it might have come back. Because not every GP, you can get junior doctors who don't know the symptoms. And that worrying is hell. But if you say that, they should then send you into the breast team for someone to assess you and do a scan if needed.
If you've already had breast cancer, you should also have a contact within the hospital, which is often one of the, I've forgotten the name now, but you should have a number to call where you can speak to a nurse and tell them what's happening with you as well.
But all too often, sadly, your breast care nurses can't book you into a clinic because the money doesn't follow the patient. And they will nearly 9 times out of 10 say, contact your GP to send you in.
Okay.
So if any new symptom, if you can't get hold of your GP, there's often the website, you could even just make an appointment with a nurse receptionist, say, I have breast cancer and I think it has come back. Someone will get you in to the clinic.
Great.
Please don't sit at home. I've been there. And sometimes I want a yearly scan just to stop my brain going, oh my God, I'm dying. And then you think, oh, I did bang my head a month ago. That's why I've had a funny headache. It's not Mets, but don't worry.
My top tip there is to keep a diary on your phone or in your notes app, wherever. I actually started this probably more than 5 years ago after reading the book Period Power by Maisie Hill.
Oh,
And tracking all my menstrual symptoms. And it then transformed into, now I carry it on every single day. I put in how I'm feeling, anything that's wrong with me, so that when I did have secondary breast cancer symptoms, I knew exactly when they'd started and what I was feeling on what particular day.
That's a great tip.
It's really handy. What can we do to be trying to prevent cancer?
Oh, it's boring and it's not sexy and you won't like me for saying it, but we know the two biggest risk factors to getting breast cancer are being a woman and getting older. Being born a biological woman, you can't change that. Regular exercise, aerobic and weightlifting, can reduce your risk of getting breast cancer by 30%. Now, that's still only a small amount. When you're young, your risk of getting breast cancer is small, so it's only a small decrease. But that's something you can do. But it's boring. The next thing is eating a healthy plant-based diet and trying to keep your body weight at a healthy range for your height. The more body fat you have, especially around the time of the menopause, the higher your risk of getting breast cancer. And the third boring and pleasant thing is to cut back on what you drink, because alcohol can cause breast cancer, start those spelling mistakes to happen. There is nothing else.
I actually don't think exercise is boring at all. I love exercise. I don't particularly like drinking and I love really nice food. So I think we can do all of those things unboringly.
You can. I'll admit I did no exercise at school. I hated it. I was a cycling widow. I only got into sport because I never saw my husband. He was cycling. And now I love it and I wish I'd done it earlier. And there are so many apps and the challenges you can do with breast cancer now to help. I think if you told me when I was your age, I'd have said, no, don't be silly, I had no time. But it's that education of getting girls in their teenage years to say, look, cancer is happening. And it's not just breast cancer this prevents, it's colon and lung. So
it is very hard to think, you know, when you're a teenager or you're in your early 20s, you do still think that I can worry about that when I'm older.
I'm invincible.
I can.
It's not going to happen to
all
me.
All the rubbish food now and I can worry about all of that when I'm your age. I think you mentioned metastatic cancer before. Is that the same as secondary?
Yeah, great question, because people get confused. Metastatic is the same as secondary, which is the same as stage four disease. And that means the cancer that has spread beyond the site of origin. So it's gone to the lungs, the liver, the bones, the brain. It's not the same as local or local regional recurrence, which is what I've had, and there's very little literature. And that means that breast cancer has either spread to the skin or the tissues around the chest wall, and that is still potentially treatable and curable.
And when breast cancer spreads to the bone, or when breast cancer spreads to the liver, for example, yeah, that's not liver cancer then, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. It is breast cancer that has spread to a different site. But when we go back and think of family history, we often don't know what our grannies and granddads died from. And they may have had liver cancer, but that could have been liver mets from a breast cancer, say.
Yes. OK, yeah, that makes sense. So when we talk about secondary breast cancer being treatable but not curable,
yeah,
it's quite hard for some people to understand that. So what does that mean?
The treatment of breast cancer is to remove it. And that's why almost everybody, if they're fit and well to have an operation, has an operation to remove it. Everything else we do is to reduce the risk of it coming back to get metastatic breast cancer. Once it has gone beyond the breast, and we can explain why this happens, we can't excise your lungs or your liver or your brain because you need them. So we physically can't remove all the cancer to cure you. What we can do is treat it. Now, that may mean removing some of the lesions in the liver or the lung, or doing radiotherapy on a bone to kind of reduce the tumours that are there, but we know there are cells in the body. So we can give treatment to prolong your life, to reduce the side effects of symptoms. And since I wrote my first book, there are now 20 new drugs available for people with metastatic disease. It is incredible. So Chris Alenga has been alive for 15 years now with metastatic HER2-positive cancer. So it's not the 2 or 3 years and you're done that it used to be.
So what leads to breast cancer coming back?
We don't know why it happens, but what we assume is whenever a breast cancer develops, it means there are cells that can leave the breast and wander around the body. And you can have that with a 2 millimeter breast cancer. It doesn't need to be big. Most of those cells are just floating around your blood and your lymph system. They're fast asleep and they may never wake up, or chemotherapy, radiotherapy, tamoxifen, Herceptin will kill them. But sometimes 6 months, 10, 20, 30 years later, those cells can wake up and start growing and find a friend and build a new home in your bones and your lungs and your liver. And we don't know what that final trigger is that makes them wake up. But that's why it's so important that, as scary as it is, we know what the symptoms of recurrence are and you know what to do when you have them. And that's why the Breast Cancer Now website is great for ductal and lobular cancer. It's terrifying, but you need to know what to look out for.
People with secondary or metastatic cancers sometimes are told that they have no evidence of disease, or
yes,
NED. What does that mean?
Well, I never used it as a surgeon. It's a very American thing. And Tricia wrote my book, said, I'm NED. And I said, what? I've never heard of this. It basically means that on a scan, we cannot see any tumour deposits, which is the best news you want to hear. It doesn't mean there aren't any. It just means they're too small to be seen with the naked eye. And we measure you with scans to hopefully see the treatments are working, so your blood numbers drop, your scans drop, and that means the drugs are working and you will stay on those drugs. But when the cancers start to grow again on a scan, we know they've developed resistance because the cancers are mutating all the while. And that's when you may change to another line of treatment, the next treatment option available, to hopefully make you NED again.
So a line of treatment is basically a drug that you've been given, and then if that stops working, you then get given another drug.
Yeah, exactly. So the first line of treatment is the first treatment you are given for your own individual type of metastatic breast cancer. And at some point that will stop working because cancer cells develop resistance. When it does, you'll go on to the next drug, and that's called the second line.
Do we only use that terminology in metastatic cancers?
Yes, we do. So for primary breast cancer, you are either given a hormone treatment, which is tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, or the Herceptin drug that is right for you, and you're given the best guess of the treatment we know at the moment. If it comes back, then you will start with the lines. So we'll start with the next one for you, and then we'll keep going down the lines.
And is it always the case? Does a cancer always eventually overpower the line of treatment?
Yeah.
There aren't any cases where...
There are cases of radical remissions. There are people who've written books where your immune system suddenly cures yourself, and that's in all sorts of different cancers. Very little evidence. There is always hope that things can happen. People will live longer. But generally, the cancer has spread, like it had with my mum, like it has with you. We know at the moment there isn't a cure. Mm. But that's at the moment. We never know what's around the corner.
Yeah. The term, you said the term NED is very rarely used in the UK, although we do use, full metabolic response, complete metabolic response, which is similar, I think.
Complete pathological response.
Yeah.
So we use that with primary people when we give you chemo before surgery. And we give you chemo before surgery for two reasons. One is to try and shrink it down, because some women with a very large tumour, it can disappear completely, so you can have a lumpectomy. The other is if you've got triple negative or you've got a large cancer, you're young with lymph nodes, we want to give you life-saving treatment first. And another benefit is we can monitor the response of the cancer to that. So when we look at your breast, with a pathologist looks at the breast after surgery, if there's no cancer left, that's a complete pathological response.
Okay. And another term that we use, that we don't use in the UK, I find, is remission.
Yes.
I was never, in my 9 years without my breast cancer coming back before it did come back, I was never told the word remission.
We use that more for bloodborne cancers like leukemias and lymphomas.
Okay.
Because they wax and wane. So they tend to go into remission and they come back. We tend not to use it for solid tumours like breast cancer.
Okay. What does the word prognosis mean?
Prognosis means what is your chance of not dying of breast cancer? And it's your chance of being alive in 5, 10, 20, 30 years. Now, there's a lot we don't know. As a rule of thumb, the younger you are, the bigger your cancer, the higher the grade, the more lymph nodes involved, the less likely you are to make it to 70 or 80. Just with all the evidence we have, but this is based on data that's 10 years old without the drugs we have. But I've looked after women in their 60s who've had a tiny ER-positive breast cancer and it's come back in a year. Mm. And I've looked after young women with a huge triple-negative breast cancer who are still alive 30 years later. There's so much about the individual molecular genetic changes we don't know. But prognosis is using all the information we have about your individual cancer to tell you your chances of still being alive in 10 years.
When people receive a diagnosis and they're interested to know about their prognosis or their survival rates, where should they look for that information?
I think the first thing is to ask your surgeon. Most of us are very good at having this conversation compassionately. Not everybody wants to know. It can be scary to hear, and it's making sure you're prepared to hear that information and picking up the pieces if it's not what you thought it was. If you want to do it yourself, there's a great free website called NHS Predict, which is what your doctors use, and you can put in all your tumour details and it will tell you the benefit of hormonal therapy, Herceptin and chemotherapy, and the chance, your odds of being alive in 5 or 10 years. But no one knows whether you're in the group that will make it or the group that won't. Only time will tell.
Yeah. Another word that we don't tend to hear so much now is terminal. Is that synonymous with secondary metastatic, or is it now used to mean something else?
Technically, you could say terminal is anyone whose breast cancer has spread. So metastatic, stage 4, recurrent. It's all terminal because it means it can't be cured. But I think oncologists would use the word terminal when the treatments have stopped working and there's no treatment left. And then we're looking at supportive care to help you live for as long as you can, as comfortably as you can.
What does the word palliative mean?
Palliative is quite a confusing word in the media. Palliative care basically means supportive care for anyone who's got a chronic illness. Now, my mum had her arm amputated for metastatic bone cancer, and I referred her to the community palliative care team for pain control, and she thought I had her dead and buried. And a lot of people think palliative care means the last 2 or 3 days of your life. It's not. You could be referred to a palliative care team from day one of a cancer diagnosis if you've got chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease. It's supportive care. And what palliative care does is look after you as a whole, physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally. And it's pain control, it's diet, it's helping you with your wishes. And they are a brilliant team to get to know. Ideally, anyone whose cancer has come back should be referred to the palliative care team. And they don't just work in the hospice, they work in the community, they come to you at home, they make everything a lot less scary. And they can tell you what's likely to happen when you are ready to hear that information.
And that's the same for hospices, isn't it? They're not just for dying in.
No.
They actually have, they can offer you massages and therapy and all sorts of really wonderful things.
They're wonderful places. And I think so many of us think that if you've got metastatic breast cancer, you are on your deathbed. And we've seen pictures in the cinemas of people who look awful. Everyone in this room could have metastatic cancer. There are people working, being really productive, hiking up mountains. It doesn't mean the end of the world, and it's no reason not to stop living. So it's worth going along to the local hospice. Plus, they can offer counselling and support, just like Maggie's Centres can for your family and your friends, so they can help you too.
Maggie's Centre is really wonderful. We have a Maggie's at my local hospital.
Oh, do you?
And I just love to go there and just sit in a quiet corner and have a free cup of tea whilst I'm waiting in between endless appointments.
I wish if your hospital had a Maggie's Centre, when you've had a diagnosis of breast cancer, you were told just go to Maggie's on the way home and sit and have a cup of tea and just debrief and talk to someone and realise this is normal, we're going to help you cope.
And have a cry because they have boxes of tissues there and lots of pamphlets and leaflets and things as well.
It's really important.
It feels to me that more and more people are being diagnosed with breast cancer younger and younger.
Yeah.
Is that actually the case, or is it just the community I'm in?
No. We know that breast cancer is on the increase in people under the age of 45. And we also know that younger women tend to have more aggressive disease. It tends to be more triple negative where there are fewer treatments, and we don't know why. But it's still not as high as you think, because breast cancer is still more common in 50s, 60s, 70s. When you're in your 40s, your risk of getting breast cancer is 1 in 64 women. When you're 75, it's 1 in 25. When you're 90, it's kind of 1 in 2 or 3. But I also think we're talking about it more on social media. Young women with breast cancer are on Instagram and TikTok sharing their stories, but your granny isn't. So we're kind of skewed that it's everywhere. But it is happening, and there is no screening for women. Your breasts are dense, mammograms don't work. There is nothing you can do apart from check. And that's why charities like Breast Cancer Now, Copperfield, Amy Dowden talking about how she didn't check her breasts, us coming and saying do it, is really, really important. And GPs, I never treated anyone with breast cancer under the age of 40 until I became a consultant. And that was after 20 years of training. It was a disease of my granny. But I think now GPs are becoming more aware that breast cancer can happen in young women, and we are sending women up to clinics to get them checked out.
What is chemotherapy and what does it do?
So chemotherapy is a drug that aims to kill cancer cells, because cancer cells are growing much more quickly than the other cells in the body. And there are a variety of drugs, some antibiotics, some plant-based chemicals, and we often use two or three that kind of work on different parts of a cell. A bit like in a car, one would go for the brakes and one would go for the indicators and one would go for the engine. Because they kill cells that are growing, you get side effects, because they affect every cell in the body that is growing. So that's why you lose your hair, all the hair. Who knew you lost all the hair on your body? I had no idea until someone said your pubes fall out first and I went, what? I had no idea. I'm a surgeon.
Even when you're a surgeon?
I just thought you lost the hair in your head. Where does your leg hair go? It's like overnight the bed bugs come and just hoover it all up. It's really weird. But that's why you get changes in your nails that can get soft and weak. You get change in your taste, the taste buds, the lining of the mouth. You get the heartburn, indigestion, diarrhea, constipation, piles, aches and pains, because your body is changing all the while. We give chemotherapy if there's more than a 5% chance of it helping you live more than 10 years. It's not a guaranteed cure. And a lot of people don't understand this. They assume chemo will work. There's no guarantee, but we know if we give it to enough women like you, it will help the lives of some of you. And it does cause collateral damage. You can lose the feeling in the fingers of your toes, the brain fog. I still can't do anagrams anymore. My brain doesn't work. Mm-hmm. We know Amy Dowden ended up in hospital with serious infections. It is not something we give lightly.
Mm. And what effect does cancer treatment have on people's fertility if they are premenopausal?
The younger you are, the more likely your ovaries are to recover. I had chemo when I was 40, so my ovaries didn't recover. The older you are, the less likely they are. But that's another really difficult thing to have. I had a 30-second discussion of, you're going to be infertile. Do you have kids? No. Well, sorry, we'll move on. And it's one more thing that cancer takes away from you. But we do know if you want to get pregnant after breast cancer, it is safe to do that. The positive trial showed it doesn't increase the risk of recurrence. And we generally say wait 2 years of your treatment. But you cannot breastfeed if you are having chemotherapy or Herceptin therapy. And you can't get pregnant if you're taking tamoxifen or the CDK inhibitors, because those drugs can damage a growing fetus.
And when you say you can't get pregnant, you actually can get pregnant. You shouldn't get
You shouldn't.
Pregnant.
What
it's
I mean
dangerous
is if you get pregnant, there is a chance that your baby will be, it won't form properly.
Yeah. But physically, you can get pregnant. Physically, so you can get pregnant. So yes, thank
you.
Yeah,
you should use contraception if you're having any breast cancer treatment.
Yeah. And what about measures to preserve fertility in younger patients before they go through chemotherapy? What can they do?
So I think at the moment, everyone on the NHS should be offered fertility preserving treatment.
And back in 2012, I was given the option of preserving my eggs before I started chemotherapy when I was 29. But there was some lack of knowledge around whether stimulating the estrogen in order to freeze the eggs could be dangerous, because estrogen is the thing that stimulates the cancer. Yeah. Is that considered to be safe?
I didn't have it for the same reason, because I had a big cancer. But what we'll sometimes do is give you letrozole to switch off the estrogen you're making outside of that. There is a risk, and your oncologist and gynecologist should have that discussion with you to say the pros and cons and how important it is for you. And I'm not sure whether you're single, that will change what you can do. If you don't have a partner, you can't fertilize an egg. It's really complicated, but there are options.
I do remember being told that, actually, as a single person, well, you could freeze an embryo if you wanted. I was like, okay, who's... Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
You mentioned letrozole and Dodex. What is an aromatase inhibitor? Because I know you mentioned that before.
Yeah. So there are two ways we can stop breast cancer cells getting estrogen. Tamoxifen works by blocking estrogen attaching to breast cells, but it can go elsewhere. So it can go to your bones, it can go to your brain. So that has the lowest amount of menopausal side effects. And anybody can have tamoxifen. After the menopause, your ovaries stop working, but we produce a little bit of estrogen in an enzyme in our fat called aromatase. What aromatase inhibitors do is stop that enzyme turning sex hormones into estrogen, so you don't make any. And that's why the menopausal side effects are much worse, and you're at a risk of getting bone thinning osteoporosis with an aromatase inhibitor. And there are three different types: anastrozole and letrozole, which are non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors, and exemestane, which is a steroidal one. And that just means they work in different ways. You don't need to worry about it.
And what is radiotherapy?
So radiotherapy is used to reduce the risk of a local recurrence or to treat someone who's got a metastasis in their bone. What it does is use a high-dose X-ray treatment to target the area where the breast cancer was, to kind of zap any cells that are still there, that are still growing.
And that in the US is usually called radiation.
Yes, radiation treatment, yeah.
What research is being done into finding a cure for breast cancer?
There is so much. And I think we're a long way off finding a cure from breast cancer, because there are so many different types. And when it comes back, it can come back in so many different ways. So to try and find 10 women or men who've got the same metastatic breast cancer is really hard. But we are looking at the HER2 vaccine. There are trials going ahead in the States that have showed this may work. There are trials looking at HER2-low breast cancers. And the molecular medicine is coming in all the while. So we're now testing for the PIK3 mutation, which I have with my lobular cancer, developing new drugs for that. And I think it's really exciting to see what's around the corner. But I think we're a long way off finding a cure for everybody, sadly.
We all saw with the COVID vaccine that, you know, it was developed in less than a year and rolled out to the entire globe.
Yeah.
How come it's not possible to pool all our global resources and do that with cancer?
I think there's a bit of everybody wants to be the first to find that magic drug, because the kudos you get. And when you collaborate together, you kind of have to share the glory. And I think so you've got lots of different labs competing to try and be the first person to do that. But what I would love, especially for all the rare cancers who don't have the money in the research, is we just all merged it together, because people are dying, waiting for these drugs to be developed. And I'd love everyone to do, as you said, let's just pull together for the greater glory, guys. This is about stopping people dying of cancer, not about winning a Nobel Prize. But I would love breast cancer share their research with prostate and lung and bone and brain, and we're doing this, we're doing that. Let's just all work together for the greater good, please.
And of course, I know that the charities do work together. Breast Cancer Now works with lots of different charities and, you know, on lots of different initiatives and things. So please let there be lots of collaboration.
We've shown it can be done, and we've shown you can run trials virtually. I live in Suffolk, and we don't have access to the trials you get at the Marsden, the Christie. If you're diagnosed in Great Yarmouth, you're kind of screwed. And I love us to get access for anybody to be on a trial.
Where can people go for support and help if they have mental health issues off the back of breast cancer?
I think the first thing to do is to find one of the online tools to say, are you depressed or anxious? There are a list of symptoms. For me, it's often the physical signs. I stop sleeping, my appetite goes, I'm ratty. So you can do a checklist to say, do you have depression or anxiety? A good place is actually to go to your breast care nurse, because a lot of Macmillan centres offer free counselling, and I've had that twice. Incredible. And for me, it's talking to someone anonymous. I don't need to worry about how she's going to feel when I leave the room, because she's trained to deal with what I'm going to tell her. Whereas if I talk to my husband, I worry I'm not that honest. So often there's free counselling available. Local Maggie centres, if you've got a local cancer centre near you, and your GP. There is no harm in saying, I need a tablet. And actually, antidepressants can also help with the hot flushes of the menopause. And that's why I'm on one for both reasons. But there is help available. It is normal. Scanxiety is another thing. That, oh my God, I can't believe it. My letter's coming up. There's nothing you can really do about that. But I think telling your family, I'm going to be an irritable, stroppy cow because I've got a scan coming up. And you can tell me it's fine, but I won't believe you. But just give me a bit of leeway here. I'll be fine when it's all done. I think preempting and pre-warning can help as well.
And you mentioned the menopause and various side effects and symptoms there. If you've had breast cancer, can you have HRT to help with the symptoms of the menopause?
You can have anything you like, but it's finding someone to prescribe it and understanding the pros and cons. And there are two schools of thought, but the latest evidence, the latest trials, the latest international guidelines say that HRT should be a last resort, systemic HRT, so the patches and the pills for anyone with breast cancer. And that's because two studies have shown it increases the risk of recurrence, and if it comes back, it can't be cured. Now, there are some people who have crippling menopausal symptoms, especially psychiatric. And if you've tried everything and you need it and you can accept the risk that if your breast cancer came back, it could be due to HRT and you want to take it, I don't have a problem with that. As long as you know there are risks that show it might increase the risk of that happening. With triple negative breast cancer, it is probably safer. But as we discussed earlier, triple negative can mutate to have ER positive receptors. And there's a risk that HRT might trigger and feed those cells in the future. So a last resort. But there are so many things you can do to help now. The British Menopause Society has a list of about 10 or 12 different drugs that can help with symptoms, complementary therapies, diet, exercise, sleep. They can all help. And they do generally fade in time.
Liz, I've grilled you enough for one day, and frankly, I could go on forever. I've got so many more questions I could ask you, but we've taken up lots of your time already. Fortunately, you have a podcast, two books, and a YouTube channel. What's the best way for people to find you online?
So I should say, just put Liz O'Riordan into Google and you'll find me.
Okay.
My YouTube channel is Dr. Liz O'Riordan, and that's where I put videos 8-10 minutes long, just explaining everything about breast cancer. On Instagram and X, Twitter, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm Liz O'Riordan. You can ask me a question, I'll answer it. It's the same with a podcast. I just love doing this to help people know that they're not alone and it's not as scary as they think.
You have become a real go-to person within the cancer community, and it's so fantastic. And I know that so many of us are grateful to you for being there and, you know, sharing all your knowledge with us.
Didn't make
you cry. Oh, sorry. So, yes, thank you. We'll put all those links in the show notes. Liz O'Riordan, thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you, Laura.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.